Since 2001, the U.S. government has detained thousands of people at prisons like Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and Bagram Air Base. The legality of many of those detentions has been challenged repeatedly, and we thought now is a good time for an update on the current situation. Joining us is Alex Gibney, a filmmaker whose award-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side about abuse in Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base is now showing here in New York at the Angelica and at the Village East, and Shaina Kadidal, who is head lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights Guantanamo Project. I'm very pleased to welcome you both to the show. Hello.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Alex, you were here last to talk about your film Taxi to the Dark Side. Can you remind us what it's about?
The story focuses on the case of a young Afghan taxi cab driver who was apprehended by Afghan militia and turned over to American forces in Afghanistan. He was taken to the Bagram prison. After 5 days of interrogation, he was dead. The army initially said it was natural causes, but an investigation by the New York Times revealed that he had been tortured and brutally beaten, so much so that his legs, the coroner said, had been pulpified.
Hasn't it also been determined that he really had nothing to do with terrorism, that he was completely innocent?
He was a pure innocent, I think it's fair to say, as were the three men in his taxi cab who were sent on to Guantanamo for no reason.
So why would they pick him up? I can't imagine they just want to pick up every innocent person in Afghanistan.
In this particular case, it was actually a more pernicious thing. The people who picked him up were the people who actually launched a rocket attack against an American base. They would do this. They would commit an act like that. They would pick up innocent people. They would turn them over to the Americans in order to curry favor. But I think it also demonstrates that, in the early days of the Afghan conflict and also in Iraq, we set in motion a kind of procedure in which we were paying bounty for prisoners and other things. We were doing all sorts of things to so-called collect information, but it resulted in a lot of innocent people being processed through the system.
Now, this is a detention center at an air base. Where is Bagram?
Bagram is about an hour or so outside of Kabul in Afghanistan. It's an old Russian air base, and it's actually not just a prison. A lot of military forces are there, and it's also a small town. That's where, if you're an innkeeper in Kabul, you go to get beer.
Because it's illegal in Kabul.
Yeah. That's what Bagram is. And inside Bagram, there's a thing called the Bagram Collection Point, which was a place where they would interrogate prisoners and then sometimes ship them onto a Guantanamo. Recently, Bagram has been expanding as Guantanamo has been winding down or the number of prisoners in Guantanamo has been reduced. But Bagram now is expanding again.
Do we know how many people are there?
I don't know exactly, but
I don't think we're really sure about it either. It's a little bit more of a black hole in some senses in Guantanamo. At least at Guantanamo, lawyers can go down. They can get some sense from other detainees of what's happening, of when flights are coming in. Bagram's much more of a mystery. And then there's Pulacharki prison also, where we have some sense of, people being warehoused after their release from Guantanamo.
So you would not be able to film there?
No, I asked for permission to go to Bagram. Nobody that I know of has been allowed in to film, but we did obtain photographs from inside Bagram prison and also the autopsy photographs of Dilawar himself.
You interviewed quite a few former interrogators for your film. How did you get access to them?
Well, they had left the military, both interrogators and MP, military police, the people who were allegedly guarding Dilawar, though they administered many of the blows. And I think that there was a sense from many of them who had been punished for some of the damage that had been done for the death of Dilawar, that while they had done something terribly wrong, they had been scapegoated because they had been punished while the people who either condoned or ordered them to do what they did were barely investigated and certainly weren't charged or convicted.
And you got the feeling that they had been traumatized by the experience as well. So torture can have an effect on the torturers as well.
We don't often think about that, but it's absolutely true. They're haunted by it and deeply scarred. So they, I see many of them now, and they come up to sometimes they do Q&A sessions after the film, and they're having a very hard time.
Shaina, is what Alex is telling us about Bagram similar to what's happening or has happened in the past at Guantanamo and other detention centers?
Certainly. You know, and I should add that a lot of what we know about Bagram comes from prisoners who were detained at Guantanamo, because an awful lot of people who were captured in that area of the world were moved through those facilities first and describe the treatment there as some of the worst that they experienced.
So they go from one facility to the other?
Sure, sure. You know, a lot of these places are sort of way stations, and folks end up at Guantanamo at the end of the trail. The question you're asking really, in some ways, is asking, you know, at what high level, how high level were these decisions made? And it's very clear at this point that they were taken in Washington, the decisions to use these coercive or enhanced interrogation techniques, that they were made at the highest levels by people who often weren't intelligence professionals, but were military officials, people like Donald Rumsfeld. Who signed off on specific techniques used on our client, Mohammed al-Qahtani, for instance.
Well, we'll get to Donald Rumsfeld later, but this isn't just something that's happened with Americans. Last November, the Canadian military stopped transferring prisoners to Afghanistan's government after evidence turned up that these people were being abused and tortured. Mm-hmm. So I guess there are others who are doing this sort of thing as well. Do we have any idea of how many camps there are right now? Do we know all the names?
No, not really. I mean, you know, we know that a lot of Guantanamo detainees came through Bagram or Kandahar, that there are a number of other sort of, you know, quote-unquote secret, you know, probably run by the CIA facilities that we do know about, because people who were held there turned out to have been picked up by mistake and were released.
And are we assuming that some are worse than others?
Well, I think those probably are, you know, based on the things that Khalid El-Masri has said after his release, that the black sites are probably the places where some of the worst things happen.
My guests are Shane Cardinal of the Center for Constitutional Rights Guantanamo Project and Alex Gibney, a filmmaker. His award-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side is now at the Angelica and the Village East. Well, aren't we still finding it difficult to locate a government official who will define what is or isn't torture? Attorney General Michael Mukasey says that it's no longer necessary to even determine whether waterboarding is torture because it's no longer employed as an interrogation technique.
Right. Well, the ambiguity obviously, serves the interests of the people who implemented these procedures down the road when the time comes when they may have to defend themselves in either civil damages lawsuits by the victims or criminal prosecutions if that should happen. And certainly a lot of immunity has been conveyed to these people by the Military Commissions Act as well.
So they can determine privately that it's torture, but because they don't want to set legal precedents, they won't admit to it.
Right, right. It's obviously a terrible thing if you're a CIA agent who's carried out these procedures on someone to have the Attorney General come out and say definitively that they're torture.
Well, Alex, you make it clear in your film that torture had been tacitly approved in Afghanistan under U.S. Captain Carolyn Wood, and she then brought those techniques into Abu Ghraib. After the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, top military officials denounced what had happened. They said it was just a case of a few bad apples. Maybe we should listen to a little clip, and then we can talk about that a little more.
It was only the night shift. There's always a few bad apples.
It's been a body blow for all of us.
This is clearly an isolated incident.
The conduct of a very, very small number of our leaders and soldiers.
A clip from Alex Gibney's film, Taxi to the Dark Side. And that was a montage of denials, government denials.
That's right. And that's been the key government strategy, really, or administration strategy on this whole issue, is to focus a lot of attention on Abu Ghraib and say, look, something very bad happened there. It was just a lot of rogue people, a few bad apples. But one of the things that Taxi shows is, as you say, Leonard, that a lot of these techniques move from Bagram to Abu Ghraib, and also from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib, and indeed we also show from Guantanamo to Bagram. It was almost like a virus that was migrating and mutating. And some of the commands were direct, as Shane has mentioned. You know, Donald Rumsfeld had a special interrogation plan for Mohammed al-Qahtani that he personally approved. But other commands were wrapped in a kind of fog of ambiguity. On the one hand, they exerted tremendous pressure on frontline interrogators to get actionable intelligence. At the same time, they seemed to be removing all the previous rules. Did the Geneva Convention apply? We don't know. Maybe not. Probably not. Do what you need to do to get the intelligence. That's what we were told over and over and over again by the frontline interrogators.
Have you been able to learn what's happened at Bagram since you made your film?
No. I mean, like I say, we get some reports. And indeed, I should say that some of the best reporting about Bagram has continued to be done by Tim Golden, who was featured in the film. He's done some interesting reports and indeed recently.
He's the New York Times.
Of the New York Times, that's right. And he's also the one who came out with a report recently about how much the population of Bagram is increasing.
Now, you said earlier that it's being expanded, but wasn't there a plan to scale it back at one point? Shane?
I'm sorry, Guantanamo? Or
no, Bagram.
Bagram. Well, you know, the U.S. has been pumping an awful lot of money into the rehabilitation of a Soviet-era prison, Policharki, outside of Kabul. And this is, you know, something that looks much more like a what we'd recognize as a prison rather than a military base with, you know, some sort of cells for detaining people like Bagram, presumably is.
Which is kind of an improvised prison?
Right, a little bit like the first prisons at Guantanamo as compared to the new Camp 5 and 6 prisons, which look like supermax prisons here in the United States. So the U.S. has poured a lot of money into Policharki, and it's unclear yet what our intent with that is. It may be the case that, we want to sort of offload people from Guantanamo, which is a place where, you know, while it's technically sort of part of Cuban territory according to the lease, it's a place where the United States has complete de facto control, and move them into a place like Policharki, which is more seemingly under the control of the Afghan government. And if we are actually pulling the strings behind the scene, it's much easier for the U.S. government to get away with warehousing people outside of the rule of law.
Earlier this month, the New York Times, I guess it was Tim Golden, pointed out that Bagram has gotten only a fraction of the attention that Congress, policymakers, and human rights groups have given to Guantanamo. Why do you think that is? Is it because Guantanamo is closer, or because of the way the government has given access to either?
I think it may be part of the latter, but I also think that Guantanamo occupies a special place, because I think the government was very consciously trying to find a peculiar exception to the rule of law, I would argue, you know, by finding this place on Cuban territory, which was controlled by Americans. So you couldn't say it was American territory, at least from the Cuban government, but at the same time it was under American control. So maybe that was a kind of legal netherworld, whereas Afghanistan is a military base. So I think there was a lot of attention focused on Guantanamo for that reason.
Well, Shane, is Guantanamo visible enough for you, even though it's gotten more public attention?
Not quite. I think, the answer to your question, you know, there's two aspects to it, right? First of all, many of the people held at Guantanamo were, as one military official put it, low level to no level. They're so unimportant that a number of them were eventually released, and about 150 were released even before the Supreme Court decided the first, our first victory in 2004 in the Rasool case. So that exposed a great deal of the sort of abuses down there. And then after we won the case in the Supreme Court, lawyers could go down to the base. And that's been the biggest difference, that lawyers come back with the stories of their clients. And, while everything that a client tells you is presumptively classified, you cannot type it up on your home computer. You've got to go to a secure facility in D.C., and type it on a classified computer and wait for the Justice Department to clear it for release. Eventually a lot of those tales of abuse have been released, and that's why it's more visible, because, the rule of law applies there because of the Supreme Court.
There's have you gone to Guantanamo?
I'm going on my first trip on February 10th.
I remember when Guantanamo first was criticized. We were told by the government that it was just filled with a lot of bad guys. And then little by little, many of them have been released, some of them with admissions that they probably had absolutely no links to terrorism. So you have to wonder how the government is rationalizing all of that.
Right. Just to give you some numbers, over 770 people detained there, over 500 released, only about 5, I think, given formal charges. And I think the vast majority of people who are still there out of the 275 are going to be sent home and never charged either in their home countries or by the U.S.
Does that mean that they were totally innocent, or does it mean that it's just going to be hard to make a case, or they were low level enough to not really go after them?
I think it's the latter, you know. I mean, we've heard that, you know, sort of statement from a lot of military officials over the years, even before lawyers had gotten in there. And I think, you know, people are always perplexed by how this happens. And, you know, I think the answer is really, you know, you have to look at the sort of typical response of law enforcement anytime they're caught off guard by the scale of something like the 9/11 attacks. The response is to go sweep in as many people as possible, not based on evidence, but based on some profiling criteria, like being a foreigner in Afghanistan or something like that, or, you know, somebody brings you in for a bounty. And that happened with tons of these guys. We were paying $5,000 a head, you know, 20 years' wages in Afghanistan for foreigners. And, you know, everyone understands that that's going to bring in a lot of people who don't belong there in the first place, but it also puts a lot of pressure on the interrogation process, and that's what leads to these abuses.
Well, the United States has apologized for what it did with Japanese Americans during World War II. Do you think we're going to be seeing some future administration doing the same thing to for many of the people who have been detained at Guantanamo?
Well, maybe some future administration, not this one. I mean, this one's litigation strategy is to run out the clock on this president's term and never have to have a court say that any of these people were picked up by mistake. We still haven't gotten a single court to release someone based on a court order.
How many prisoners are being held currently at Guantanamo?
275 or so.
And it was originally, you said, up to 700, 800?
The total number of people held there, I think the maximum was somewhere in the 600s, but over 500 released.
They've also done a peculiar thing at Guantanamo, which is, you know, very much of a PR ploy. They've kind of turned it into a theme park. You know, you go down there as a member of the press, and you're treated to this sort of dog and pony show, which is what we show in the film. And it's designed to show a very sanitized view of Guantanamo in a way that, you know, everybody can, you can hear on the Rush Limbaugh show, et cetera. This is Club Gitmo. It's become a very conscious attempt by the administration.
My guests are Alex Gibney, whose film is Taxi to the Dark Side, currently at the Angelica and the Village East, and Shane Kadidal, who is the head lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights Guantanamo Project. And we will continue our conversation after this. I'm back with Shane Kadidal, the head lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights Guantanamo Project, and Alex Gibney, the filmmaker whose award-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side about abuse at Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base is now showing here in New York at the Angelica and the Village East theaters. You said, Shane, that you're going to go to Guantanamo for the first time. What do you hope? Well, first of all, how do you arrange something like that?
Well, the trickiest part of it is getting security clearance. First of all, only U.S. citizens can be cleared as lawyers or translators to go down there. Often presents a big problem for obscure languages where there aren't a lot of U.S. citizens who speak them. You know, that takes a couple months. You know, they go interview, you know, all your family members. It's just like applying for a job with the FBI or the Justice Department. Then once you've got clearance, you fly down to Fort Lauderdale and you get on a little tiny charter plane, you know, propeller driven, where they, you know, sort of look at the passenger to see who weighs what and balance out each side of the plane. And then you go on a long 4-hour hell ride circling around the tip of Cuba and land on the airport side of the base. There you stay in the combined bachelor quarters. And in the morning you wake up, take a ferry across to the detention side of the base. And from there on you're escorted and you meet with your clients shackled to the floor in these little huts.
How much access do you think you'll have to your client?
Well, you'll be able to talk, and there's obviously, you know, a great deal of sort of the biggest barrier, really, in some sense, is trust. You know, these are folks who, you know, the only Americans they've dealt with often, if it's a first visit, are people who are interrogators, and they have no reason to distinguish you from the interrogators. In fact, interrogators have gone to folks disguised as human rights workers, as Red Cross, as doctors, you name it. So trust is the biggest barrier, and the fact that obviously the lawyers, while we've been going down there since 2004, haven't really managed to do a whole lot for detainees through the legal process.
Assuming that you won't have total privacy either, and that your conversations with your clients might very well be wiretapped or eavesdropped in some way.
Right. They're definitely subject to video surveillance. They tell us the audio is off. The rooms are pretty thin-walled. You know, so even on that ground, people aren't certain that the communications are secure.
What's the current legal status for the detainees in Guantanamo?
Well, the biggest issue is basically before the Supreme Court, and that's really whether or not the Military Commissions Act, which purported to strip away the right to get into federal court for these detainees, whether that's constitutional.
And how have the courts acted in regard to some of these things? Earlier this month, didn't the United States Court of Appeals in the D.C. Circuit dismiss an action brought by four former British detainees against Donald Rumsfeld and some senior military officers for ordering their torture and also for religious abuse?
Right, right. This was actually for some of the individuals, the English citizens, whose case was the one that went up to the Supreme Court in 2004, Shafiq Rasool and some others. And you know what? This was a damages case, basically. It was an attempt to get some financial compensation to have some form of accountability after the fact.
And the judges said that none of this happened or that it wasn't something that was applicable by U.S. law?
Well, there are a lot of complicated questions of immunity for federal government officials, and one of them, one form of immunity, turns on whether or not the acts that happened that you complain about were in the course of employment, the ordinary course of employment. And what the court said was, well, look, you know, these people were being interrogated as military detainees, presumptively, and it's reasonably foreseeable that you will torture, people who are military detainees.
So is that
so
a setback?
All in a day's work, essentially.
So is that a setback for the people who claim to have been illegally detained at Guantanamo? Does it set a legal precedent?
You know, it's yet another form of this, of the courts throwing up their hands on imposing accountability. You know, and the frustrating thing about it is, you know, there's three different ways you could get accountability here. Habeas corpus, which is, you know, asking for your release. That's a case before the Supreme Court. These damages cases and then criminal prosecutions against these people. And the Military Commissions Act tries to erase all three, tries to keep them all out of federal courts. And, you know, the problem with that is people look at the courts as you know, sometimes I think from watching too many crime dramas on TV is a way of sort of throwing a wrench in law enforcement's plans and the efficiency of law enforcement. And really, they're there as agents of accountability and oversight to make sure we're doing a good job in, you know, interrogating people in the sort of war on terror and so forth, doing it in ways that are responsible and that may produce reliable results. Well, and what we get from keeping these cases out of court is the opposite. We get incompetent law enforcement as well as abuses that embarrass us internationally and violate the rights of these individuals.
Well, as Alex pointed out earlier, there is a certain amount of evidence that Donald Rumsfeld and others actually called for torture people. But is it likely that the courts will entertain any suits against them? Can they be seen as criminally liable?
Well, I'm not going to answer that as a lawyer.
I was asking Shane, but you can jump in at any
time. There's one thing that I wanted to get at, because it's one of the things that surprised me when I was making the film, and I didn't really hold this view at the beginning, but I'm beginning to hold it more and more now. Take the case of waterboarding, for example. It's becoming increasingly clear to me that waterboarding isn't really even an interrogation technique. You know, I just got back from Asia. I visited the Genocide Museum in Phnom Penh, and the key tool of interrogation there was the waterboard. And lo and behold, all 14,000 prisoners who were interrogated there all confessed the crimes against the state, and they were all executed. What they get is false confessions. That's what you normally get when you use the waterboard. Now, it may be that truth comes out, but the scary thing, as I'm getting around to, is that what happens when waterboarding becomes a kind of political tool, when you get exactly the kind of information that you want to pursue as a politician. We have a case in the film of Ibn Sheikh Alibi, a guy who was interrogated in Bagram by the FBI, was getting very good intelligence, but it wasn't the intelligence that the Bush administration wanted to hear. So they sent the CIA in, they rendered him, waterboarded him in Cairo, and lo and behold, there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq. But now, with Mukasey and other people refusing to say that waterboarding is illegal, are we beginning to see a point where the Justice Department is actually covering up criminal activity of the executive branch? And that poses, I think, a very difficult constitutional question.
And there's a long laundry list of false confessions that have come out of some of these abusive interrogation techniques. Shafiq Rasool, who we were just talking about, who just lost his civil damages case and was one of the people who brought the case to the Supreme Court, him and one of the other English detainees made false confessions that they were at a training camp in Afghanistan when British intelligence actually was monitoring them in England and knew that they were, had jobs at an electronics store in Birmingham and so forth. Muhammad al-Qahtani, who was subject to Donald Rumsfeld's, a special interrogation plan that he personally signed off on, implicated over 30 other Guantanamo detainees falsely. And that's a reason why some of these people who were profiled in or bought in for bounties are still there.
How many lawsuits on behalf of detainees are currently in U.S. courts?
It's hard to tell because there are a lot of names on some individual petitions, roughly about 200, I would say, in the district courts and maybe about 150 in the Court of Appeals.
My guests are Shane Cadidal, head lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights Guantanamo Project, and filmmaker Alex Gibney. His documentary Taxi to the Dark Side is now showing at the Angelica and the Village East theaters. Well, can you tell us, Shane, about CCR's lawsuit on behalf of Majid Khan? Who's she?
Well, Khan is one of the detainees that I'll be seeing on this trip in February, and he was moved to Guantanamo along with a number of the other sort of so-called high-value detainees. These are people basically who, you know, apparently were in the black site system, you know, the system of prisons that Jane Mayer has documented in her reporting as being run by the CIA for, you know, folks who the government was most interested in subjecting to coercive interrogation techniques. Now, the government, we filed a habeas petition for him. Well over a year ago, government denied us access. They said your secret level security clearances aren't high enough to be able to even talk to this detainee, even under the restrictive sort of conditions on conveying that information to the public that exist for all Guantanamo detainees. They said, you know, he has been exposed, you know, he may have knowledge of enhanced interrogation techniques that we use and also of the locations of these secret black site prisons. And that stuff is top secret. It's the highest level of classified information. We have to take much higher sort of, you know, much more stringent precautions in order to keep it not public. So they made our lawyers go through an extra clearance process, and the restrictions on conveying any of that information to the public are extraordinary.
Have the courts supported that argument?
Well, so far, I mean, basically the court hasn't really ruled on the validity of that protective order. We signed off on it because we hadn't seen him in over a year since his case was filed, and we really, you know, just wanted to get down there and get access to him. The government basically dictated terms to us.
So we have no idea where he was before he wound up in Guantanamo.
Well, we lawyers do. We just can't speak about it. And the government, has cleared very, very little information from the first meetings that took place.
Is anybody still in Abu Ghraib?
Thousands of people, I believe, right?
Yes.
The U.S. held, I think, at the peak, maybe 17,000 people in Iraq, and it's the same sort of situation. You know, folks were profiled in. If you're a Sunni in a Shiite neighborhood, that kind of thing, an attack took place nearby, you got swept in, and they relied on the interrogation, practices or anything, things like that to produce, the real suspects out of the mass of chaff.
And there was a terrible symbolic aspect to the Abu Ghraib prisons because, after all, that's where Saddam Hussein tortured and executed so many people. But also, the other thing about Abu Ghraib is that at the time when the worst abuses took place, it was very close to battle zones. And so sometimes Abu Ghraib was being mortared, and it sort of ramped up the pressure. And it's exactly what you don't want to have when you're, housing a lot of prisoners.
So in the case of Abu Ghraib, there may have been some serious detainees, people who should have been detained, but the symbolism of putting them in Saddam Hussein's prison was not lost on the Iraqi people.
Correct.
Yeah. And obviously
and so just should have had another prison altogether, found another place to put them.
Well, that's probably the long-term plan. But obviously, the only reason you need space to pull in 17,000 people is that you're pulling in people where you don't have any evidence of wrongdoing.
Well, shouldn't we assume that some of the people who are at Guantanamo or at Bagram who've been at Abu Ghraib are serious threats?
Well, sure. But it's very much like assuming that under torture, some people will say some aspects of what they say will be the truth. The problem is that it's mixed in with so much untruth that you cannot sort out the good information from the bad. And that's a problem with torture. That's also the problem with mass detention.
I think there's another problem here, too. At some point, we're going to demand justice. You know, there were some people who did commit crimes and did commit crimes against the United States. We want to be able to hold them accountable. The whole process that the Bush administration has undertaken is a process of trying to manufacture guilt no matter what. So the system is rigged to always be able to produce a guilty verdict. What kind of justice is that? You don't know who was really guilty and why. And that helps us. And it also, I mean, that really hurts us. And it also hurts our intelligence gathering techniques.
And it hurts our image abroad,
totally,
doesn't
hugely.
It? Well, we haven't heard much talk about these detention camps from the candidates who are campaigning for president. Do they all have official stances? Do you know?
Well, some of them do. You know, John McCain has come out and said that he thinks that people ought to be moved to, you know, Fort Leavenworth or someplace like that, detained in the U.S., presumably given the right of access to federal courts and tried in ordinary criminal proceedings, presumably.
He's been the only Republican candidate to come out against torture.
Right. He's the only Republican.
Circumstances.
Right. The only Republican candidate who actually was tortured. Right. And I think that probably plays into it.
And Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama?
You know, they both made pretty good statements about closing Guantanamo. You know, their current positions are both pretty good in terms of, you know, not wanting to try people in a military process. And, you know, keep in mind, the entire scheme set up by the Military Commissions Act of military tribunals for all these folks who will be charged is entirely directed at the notion of using coerced evidence, torture evidence against them. That's the only reason we're not trying these people in federal courts.
So is it really the people who are who are doing the debates from CNN and elsewhere, is it their responsibility to bring this sort of thing up?
I think in part it's their responsibility to bring this sort of thing up, but I also think it's the responsibility of the candidates to discuss it more. I mean, this is really a huge issue. This is really not just about interrogation techniques. This is about respect for the rule of law, which is fundamental to who we are as Americans. And I think it's also fundamental to how we want to be seen around the world and, indeed, how to fight a war on terror. You can't fight a war on terror if you're playing by the rule book of the terrorists. One thing that Osama bin Laden has said, and it's also consistent with what the goal of many terrorists is the goal of a terrorist is not to gain territory or land. It's to provoke liberal democratic societies to try to undermine their own principles. In the case of Osama bin Laden, I would have to say mission accomplished.
Alex Gibney's film, Taxi to the Dark Side, is playing in New York City at the Village East and the Angelica Theaters. We have a link with more information, including the film's website, up on our show page at WNYC. And you can also go to our website to find out more about the Center for Constitutional Rights and what they're doing to stop illegal detentions. My guest, Shaina Katidal, is representing some of the detainees at Guantanamo. I want to thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Leonard.
On tomorrow's show, John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji, hosts of The Takeaway, WNYC and PRI's new morning news show, with a preview of the Super Tuesday primaries, also a new film about an Arab musical group that's stranded in Israel, then Martin McDonagh on his new film In Bruges, Ruth Reichel and Jonathan Waxman explain how chefs create menus, and our latest political projection looks into how Hollywood has poked fun at politics over the years. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Barbara Kahn, Paula Crossfield, and Angie Sheldon. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.